Test, test. 2, 4, 6, 8. Rid the segments from your mind. The universe is mad with lines. Test. Few are called, many come anyway. Test.
Lonely feeling deep inside. Find a corner where I can hide.
Need any more Simsian aphoristic couplets to help our sound check along here? Test. How about Great Hallam Legends I Have Known, number 2 in the series of 6? Test. That would be Michelangelo. Really? Michelangelo. And his curve. It was an untamed thing. Test. I can keep talking about Michelangelo for a long time and put off being my opinionated collection of 79 people and or aggregates of people for some time now. Test. Michelangelo's curve. 'Twas an untamed thing, as big and loopy as a Colorado River cutbank. Test. He drew it on a field of ecstatic blue. A laughing parabola. A spinnaker. A long cold tail of mad white ice. Test. When you saw it, it flashed by and was gone, like it moved all by itself. But he tossed it off, Michelangelo did. Toss it off his easel into the scrub, like so many others, into the scrub at the bottom of that dry arroyo they used to call the Zephyr River. But he'd just paint another one, and 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 another one. Patience of Sisyphus had Michelangelo Torre. Painted from 4, until he heard the bell of St. Augustine's ring 4 times. At which time he would survey his work scattered in the barranca. And by then that curve burned across his mind, lit up a place behind his eyes, tortured him, and guided him. 100 or more of these cardboard canvases zipped and darted with that infernal crescent. They lay everywhere, here and there, everywhere, indifferently, immodestly, among the weeds and the stunted trees. They lay there, here, there, everywhere, immodestly, indifferently, and they mocked Michelangelo. They mocked him like bitter women, and so he left them there. All of them left them there to swell and stain and crack from the dew and the drying. And then the next day he'd go back and try again to make an image he could take home and love. Okay, where did that come from? Who's interrupting the work here? Michelangelo Torre. Michelangelo Torre died in 1966, before I ever heard of Hallam, much less lived here, before I'd ever even set foot here in heavenly, heathen, Hurstian, Huxleyan California, where everything happens at once and music plays all the time, all the time. Now, I can leave this alone, and I will, but he stands outside of me in ways I can't grasp, this Michelangelo Torre, with his passions and his work and his damn curve. which have a kind of inevitability about them, a fixedness, a long-linedness, which is completely at odds with everything I know about this town, and which I can't appropriate and use at all, in ways I'm used to appropriating and using almost everything I come into contact with, and which makes me damned uncomfortable. And then there's this life of his of blood and bone. It has a smell to it of fried foods and dust and eucalyptus trees, and his madnesses and his recklessnesses and his bayings at the moon. They're not mythic. They are real. They are solid. He's been dead 25 years, but they are solid as hell and unselfconscious and absolutely glorious and absolutely maddening. He is so real, so long-lined, that I have no relation to him at all. Because I'm made up of myth, metaphor, the act of filtering experience into image, and the subsequent implosion of image back into me.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, how in the world do I do that?
Bet you didn't think I knew how to rock and roll.
Or maybe the better question is, why in the world do I do that?
Tell me why.
I know. Sweetness. Cleanness. Greenness. Gone.
How far appearances constitute being.
If I don't know you like,
is the thing he demonstrates.
We'll capture it and freeze.
With his constant effort.
And turn it around.
To perfect representation.
180.
For such is his art.
Degrees.
Fading absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, Harry Lyman Sims.
Much more business.
I know.
I don't want your botheration. Get away, leave me.
The legacy of rock is bent and distorted by a great many strange prisms and filters. Don't look for authentic symbols. Look for effects.
Too much monkey business for me.
Test. Test. Was that too overblown? I'd like to know. So in the card that you received as you came in today, would you fill out the questionnaire and tell me? I'd like to get your input on this. My name is Harry Lyman Sims. I was one of the first to recognize culture as commodity. I myself am a commodity, amounting to 79 people and or aggregates of people which play rock and roll. Thank you for coming today, tonight. It's nice to be back in my hometown of Hallam, that town with a grumpy, prosaic, Republican-sounding name, like a squat, horizontal building. It's also wonderful to be here in the fertile, reverberant atmosphere of the Extensions of Man Cable Company Coliseum. It's nice. They never had anything like this when I was growing up here 20 years ago. But my growing up here 20 years ago does have some bearing on what I am now and what I'm doing here for you tonight. The question really is, why do I do this? And the answer is that basically I am a man without a center, and perhaps even a man without a soul. And I'd like to tell you about some of the other people I knew here growing up in the early 1970s who also grew up without a soul. You who live here in Hallam, which is the most mediated place in the world, are terribly sophisticated in certain ways. You're terribly sophisticated about the signals and signs and symbols that you receive from elsewhere. You may not know this, but you are. When Marshall McLuhan said that we live mythically, but continue to think fragmentarily and on single planes, he wasn't thinking about you, because you indeed do think mythically and on many planes. It's one of the reasons I turned out as I did. You might say that it's a good thing. Rather like constantly seeing the world as varied as a candy store.
One, two, three.
Good luck. Good luck.
Going from song to song, image to image, and dream to dream. But on the other hand, you might say that it's like being condemned to a prison of duplicity. It is my image that I want to multiply, but not out of narcissism or megalomania, as could all too easily be believed. On the contrary, I want to conceal, in the midst of so many illusory ghosts of myself, the true me, the one who makes them move.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on to the other side.
And how do we do that?
Gotta get some money, buy some brand new shoes.
Through my first and only love.
Kathy, I'm lost, I said.
The production process. The production process girds time, laughs at experience, the plainness and the plainness of it. And that's what this town militates against, the plainness of experience lived firsthand. Why do I let the urge toward long-lined lives bedevil me? It's all just sentimentality. There's no going back. Once you gird time through production, you impose great order, and you loose great chaos. The order of a Brahms serenade, and the chaos of the Lizard King.
Try to set the night on fire.
How far appearances constitute being is the thing we demonstrate with our constant effort to perfect representation, for such is our art here, feigning absolutely. Leslie Parks. The town of Hallam, full of sun and signs and symbols and signals and semiotics and a really alarming rate of sibilant alliteration, also has a remarkable number of one-syllable surnames. Leslie Parks, Harry Lyman Sims, Oliver Mott, the scholar who believes he is reincarnated from Johannes Brahms, who was reincarnated from Clayton Fitch, an obscure early 19th century American novelist whose work he spent his life editing. Jimmy French, the professional golfer who lives more to collect his experiences and edit them into highlights of life than to live life itself. And Leslie Parks, who, as you all know, used to be part of the Parks and Hicks afternoon news team here in Hallam until she met her unfortunate demise. But did you know how exactly she did meet her maker? It's also a story of living life one step removed from experience. What happens when the gap between mere being and being in order to appear in front of a camera gets too large for that organism which simply wants to be any longer. Her makeup, quite frankly, in order to be in front of this camera, was excessive to the point of clownishness. I met her once. I was interviewed by her on the news. I did a few of my acts. This one.
She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah.
This one. The that one, and that one. And then we had a little chat. Now, television news people are innocent of irony and most humor, but they feel compelled from time to time to laugh at certain remarks because they know instinctively, it's part of their training, certain remarks seem to invite laughter of some kind. Now, in order to meet Leslie Parks, I had to overcome a certain prejudice of mine. Her angularity, quite frankly, was painful to behold. A single touch from her cheekbones to her hips, I'm sure, would have drawn blood. And I considered the risks of shaking hands with her.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven.
And when she offered up the blades of her right hand, I did take them, and if I didn't exactly close my eyes, I did wince a bit when I took the hand, and to my relief, it didn't cut. But the overall effect was supposed to be beauty, and she did have remarkable hair, dark and curly and unfathomable as a rainforest. But the beauty was laid on with a trowel, and you really needed a filter. She was made to be in front of a camera. You had to see her on TV. In person, she was simply too overwhelming to be pretty or pleasant or even quite human, because the curved space between her eyes and her brows was orange. Her cheeks were red, red, red. It didn't stop. Her lips were quite impossible. And when Leslie Parks did smile and laugh instinctively at what she thought was an appropriate time to smile and laugh at something that I said, that face, whose beauty was laid on with a trowel and had a dangerous look of brittleness anyway, simply gave up the ghost and shattered in 100 pieces. The shards fell to the floor like steak knives and severed her feet from her toes. It was, quite simply, the most unpleasant sight I'd ever seen. And immediately, every camera on the premises zoned in on her like a piranha to a goat carcass. Leslie Parks died in absolute agony hours later at a Hallam Valley hospital, but not until she'd voiced her own obit, produced the story of her demise, and starred in a cautionary videotape on the health hazards of wearing too much makeup. Her byline sounded like a death rattle, and it was. So it had happened. My imaginings, the fragments and lines of which could intersect and sometimes spark pulses of insight, but not usually run parallel or sustain themselves long enough to affect reality, had killed my imaginings, and my pretendings were lethal and homicidal.
Imagine I'm in love with you. It's easy 'cause I know it's not like me to pretend.
And that, after all the bits and pieces of lives and identities and images and signs and symbols and signals and songs, which may have been poisoning us as much as inspiring us all these years, that is the lie. Because pretending is exactly what I know best. It's what I do all the time for 20 years. I know watching, I know listening, and I know pretending. I know, and I know, and I know nothing else. There comes a time,
I'm telling
here
you,
in this town,
to understand,
to know. I'm warning you. You live here. You all live here. You
when
are subject to this.
Life seems lovelier for resembling life reproduced.
Many of us have already reached it,
are very wonderfully adapted to the age that we live in.
See, we've reached a time,
to a pathologic degree,
where fewer and fewer people be warned.
I
can distinguish between knowledge a contaminant
used
in the water, which
Jenkins Quinnell
which makes
Potter
us grow up
name. We called him
with
Jinx.
These
his was a life
dreams of a world that
lovely
never existed
dreams,
and he knew joy
a world of wonderful images but which never existed but which we seem
but I was always very sad to see
as if
maybe it's something more fundamental
a kind of
living
prenatal teratogen in our mother's wombs, which
conspired in him
never gave
to
us a chance from the very beginning.
Action seemed vain.
We can't see the words Le ciel n'est pas un pipe without the sting of surprise and a sense of loss. We can't tell the difference between a pipe and a painting.
You know you've been wrong, but it won't be long before you leave them all far behind. Cause it's the new Mother Nature taking over. It's the new splendid lady come to call. Taking over. She's getting us all. She's getting us all.
And the pursuit of those vain dreams seemed the only possible step in his life.
Because when Jinx Potter was young, he looked up at the hill which formed the west wall of our valley. And he looked at a house there. It was the clubhouse of the country club, Hallam Country Club. But before that, it had been the summer hacienda of Phoebe Apperson Hurst, a house which hung there. It seemed to hang there on that oak-choked hill, a stately hacienda, stately. And Jinx Potter would look up at it every day like a kind of proof of God's grace. This house, it represented a kind of hope of his of living in a world of elegance. Where he got the notion of elegance, I have no idea, but a world of elegance where after the slash and the sun of some vague combination of sport and life and commerce, he could enter the cool Moorish grace of this place and could talk of law and letters with men who knew, oh, I don't know, Jess Sweetser, maybe, or the Bodleian Library, who drank with Hagen and sang Gabrielli in the green gold light of San Marco, maybe gone head-to-head with Lawson Little in the British Amateur, and who had made love with Clara Bow. These dreams were absolutely perfect, and they were poetic, and they were beautiful, and they made music to him. He'd have a highball with Bobby Jones. He'd have dinner with Lillian Hellman and Eugene O'Neill, both together. And all these great and glorious dead would rise up in his dreams. And Thomas Wolfe would suddenly walk out and embrace him and talk about dark secret trains burning steady up out of old Catawba in the night, and maybe compose a couple of novels during lunch. And Jinx would talk hitting with Lou Gehrig and talk Paris with Francis Poulenc. He'd talk everything with Gertrude Stein. He'd know, and he'd know, and he'd know nothing else. This past, this wonderful sense of the past crowded into a single large room, and everyone in it knew each other. And that was Jinx's comfort. There were no strangers in the past. There was no chaos in the past. There was no exclusion. There was no being left out. There was affection and love enough for everyone, and he was warm there. He wanted to be in the past, and he made his way into the past with a kind of monument this house was. It was a green past, but past it was, and it ripened with each hour and day, and he was safe.
Okay, Jinx, that'll work. See you tonight.
I guess Harry becomes person and or aggregate of person number 80. Yeah, I know,
and I know nothing else. Except that this is an epidemic time, epidemics of all sorts attacking the body, assailing the mind, epidemics of the decay of love, of the failure of grace, and especially epidemics poaching that peculiar lightness to life, which must, really must, if life is to remain something pungent and full of sweetness, that must be kept aloft, up, buoyant, must cheat that grinding gravity which lays low our spirits like so many fallen asses of the soul. It takes vigilance, delicacy. It's tough. But in the meantime, I will do what I can, not knowing whether I help or hinder, whether I heal or poison. But I'll sing songs that others have written and tell tales of others writing songs others have written. And I will try to determine what contaminants, what waterborne symbolic cholera created such a master of irony and image as me. And why life is lovelier, the more it resembles life reproduced. But in the meanwhile, we'll go on as we have before. So here we go, entertaining ourselves to death.